I'm Marissa Donnelly, host of the Vulnerability Podcast, a podcast series focused on being vulnerable, being emotional, being deep, and talking about topics that people often shy away from. In this podcast series, you'll see stories of faith, hope, inspiration, darkness, frustration, and everything that really challenges us to speak to our human experience, and to do so in shedding our skins and being vulnerable.
Welcome back to the Vulnerability Podcast. My name is Marissa Donnelly. I'm your host, and today I'm so excited to have Dan Hill on the show. Dan Hill is the founder of Sensory Logic, and he's also an EQ author. So, Dan, welcome.
Thank you so much, Marissa.
I wanted to start off talking first a little bit about you and your background. Can you just explain to my audience briefly what Sensory Logic is and what your background's in?
Sure. I got lucky many times in life. And one time is that in 1998, someone I knew at IBM sent over an article from a now deceased Cornell University publication called American Demographics about the breakthroughs in brain science and how much we are intuitive, emotional decision makers. The killer statistic was that the conservative scientific estimation is that at least 95% of our mental activity is not fully conscious. I was frankly so excited by the article, my hands were trembling when I finished reading it. And essentially on the spot, I said to myself, this is so cool. I have no idea whether I can make a living doing this, but I have to explore the realm of emotions. And that sent me on a search for a tool, a scientific tool that helped me capture and understand emotions. And that proved to be, in my case, facial coding, which I can explain more in a moment.
Awesome. So what value do you feel emotions play? You know, when people talk about emotions, they're usually talking about, you know, counseling, relationships, you know, personal development. But what role do you feel like emotions have in business?
Well, they have a lot more business application than often gets acknowledged. The original way in which we understood emotions in business was simply one of those boring customer satisfaction surveys that you fill out when you check out of the hotel and things like that. We have no idea whether anybody ever bothers to read it. And I suspect that it's either just done on an obligatory basis, or if you're really mad about the service, then you'll weigh in. But it goes so much more broadly than that, of course. I mean, it's from who we hire, how we're managed, how we work together as a team, whether we believe in management, if we can root for them, or whether we felt very distant from them. It applies to advertising, our use of products. I mean, essentially, it goes everywhere. One of my favorite quotes is someone said, in America, there are two currencies, dollars and emotions. So for a long time, I've used facial coding in the business realm to, you know, try to basically humanize business, to make people acknowledge that emotions are really how we value and determine something. You know, what's the checklist on the emotions we have as part of the experience interacting with a company and its products and services. But I have a lot of interest beyond that, and we may or may not get into those, but I've applied this as well into my interest in personal relationships, into pro sports with draft choices and trades for teams, as a political pundit for the New York Times and CNN and so forth. So emotions are just a really broad and important subject, and facial coding is a way for me to be able to pick up the emotions of others and in business at least help quantify those emotional response as providing insights and feedback loop that's more honest than what people merely say often.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. You know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting as you were talking is recently I was helping a business owner with her content copywriting for her website. And one of the things she really wanted to focus on was how learning about people's emotions and management styles can really help as a CEO or business leader and can help you to, you know, work with your team. And I mean, it sounds so obvious when you say it, but it's also something that I don't think it's explored enough. You know, how we learn, how we manage, and then how we can manage others and how others like to be managed. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, no, it's vital. I remember when I was first getting into business, someone warned me, lived in my building. She said, remember, Dan, when you get in the business space, there are only opportunities and challenges. She said, no one ever admits that there are problems in business. It all gets glossed over, just like emotions get put to the side. But really, you know, we talk about business to business or business to consumer, you know, B2P or B2C, but it's really B2P. It's people. I mean, you work with people and you sell to people. And if you're going to really take on people seriously and respect them, then you have to bring emotions into it. I mean, if I had changed the name of my company when I started it, I might have also called it Emotions Incorporated. That was the other name I kind of played with a bit.
Emotions Incorporated. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it would have been a good title. I thought at the time I was such a pioneer in the field, quite honestly, that I thought if I explicitly put emotions into the title of my company, I might not get return phone calls. And since I was capturing emotional expressions through the face, sensory logic was a way to back off a little bit, but still intrigue people. But yeah, I'm really fond of Emotions Incorporated because they are incorporated in our lives. They should be incorporated into our business practice. They're just that important.
But you know, sensory logic really speaks to that as well. I like that title because I think people so often separate emotions from logic. Either you're an emotional person or you're a logical person, right? So when you have, you know, sensory logic put together, it's, you know, how can we use both sides of our brain, left and right? How can we use emotions and logical reasoning to really build what we're trying to build, whatever that is?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing that drives me crazy. And I've opened more than one speech this way because we are still 300 years later living with Descartes' famous saying. This is René Descartes, the French philosopher's saying, "I think, therefore I am." Well, that's at the height of the Enlightenment era. It's a long time ago. The breakthroughs in brain science has confirmed that we are mostly feeling beings. And if Descartes said, "I feel, therefore I am," the truth of the matter is that would be a lot closer. But I'm not trying to practice reverse discrimination. I'm not saying that conscious cognitive, you know, thought is, you know, irrelevant or to the side. It's not. It's part of the equation. It's just that emotions are probably, if anything, the larger of the two pieces. You can go all the way back to Aristotle, who said essentially the chariot is driven by two horses, and one is reason and one is emotion, and that the emotional horse was stronger. Aristotle said it himself, and then along, you know, came Descartes, and we kind of forgot about it. And then if it's made that, you know, emotion is female and male is logic, then that's even more crazy because everybody feels. And so there's a lot of cleanup that needs to be done in that area to get to a more realistic and fair appraisal of human nature and the role of emotions.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I have often come across in my own personal writing journey and just some of the articles that I've shared online, because I've gotten a lot of pushback of people saying, you know, "Oh, aren't you going to regret writing such emotional content?" Or, you know, "Don't you want to be taken seriously?" and things like that. And I feel that vulnerability in particular, which comes through when we are emotional and we do express our feelings, I feel like that gives us power, which is actually the reason why I started this podcast in the first place.
Yeah, no, if you can't get to something that's real, you can't get any traction. You can't move forward, essentially. We are all vulnerable. And, you know, men feel fear. Women feel fear. We feel fear right now with the coronavirus, because fear in part is when something feels like it's bigger than ourselves and we may not be able to match up against it. It is part of the human condition. And so vulnerability is just getting to authenticity. And authenticity matters immensely. I remember giving a speech in Estonia, of all places, and I got done, and the first question off the floor, someone said to me, "You're an American. You smile all the time. Isn't that fake?" And we kind of did a little bit of back and forth from the audience to myself, and I said, "I assume your supposition here, because I'm an American and we have a lot of fake smiles in advertising, that you don't believe them." And she said, "Yeah, that's true." And I said, "Well, I love what I do as a business, so I can assure you my smiles are authentic. But, you know, to put up the fake plastic smile to camouflage how we're feeling, you know, hides our vulnerability, and it hides our ability to make a connection, and it hides our ability to understand our situation better and ourselves, and essentially to move forward. So without an admission of vulnerability, we're basically taking too much out of the equation to make it work."
Yeah, you bring up a good point about the connection to other people, especially for people in leadership roles. If you're not willing to meet people on an emotional level or share any semblance of real emotion or even mistakes, I think that's what, in my opinion, separates an okay leader with an excellent leader is somebody who's not afraid to be like, yeah, I messed up, or, you know, here's what I have going on, here's what I'm thinking, and be really transparent in that sense.
Yeah, that's where you can make the progress, because we all make mistakes, and they're going to be able to relate to you and rally behind you as a leader far more easily. I'll give a little story if you don't mind. So earlier in my career, before I started Sensory Logic, I was the director of executive communications for one of the country's top five utilities. One of my responsibilities was to work with the CEO on the annual employee meeting. You talk about lack of vulnerability and kind of, you know, just camouflaging or pasting over things. Before I came there, the way this was handled was that everybody had to submit their questions in advance, and Jim Ferlin, the chairman, would stand at the podium and visibly thumb through the submitted cards and decide which ones he wanted to answer. And I said, no way, we are not doing it like that. What we're going to do instead is I'm going to go out and film a candid camera video that people can ask you questions, but we're going to merely use it as kind of the lead-in or prop for the session. So you finish your speech, we play the candid camera video, we set up mics in the aisle, and people can step up to the mic, and whatever they ask is what you're going to answer. And he went along with it. And he is, in fact, was a well-regarded CEO. At one point, the Wall Street Journal did a letter grade ranking of the CEOs relative to their performance and pay, and he was one of only about 10 A's out of 500 people. So overall, it seems like he stood up to the challenge, and here he stood up. I said, Jim, you've got a good sense of humor. It's a bit dry, but let them see you as a person, and respect their questions and take them on and don't hide. And you're going to have to be vulnerable essentially behind the podium, but that's the way this thing's going to work. And we got a 20% lift in the annual employee meeting surveys afterwards. Higher, stronger scores. The chairman was elated, and his response was he sent all of his senior management out to do a series of town hall meetings. So this stuff can work. It's not just, you know, theoretical hope that maybe we could all make some progress in life. We really can.
Yeah, absolutely. How did you first get into this arena?
Well, it was certainly that article that I mentioned from IBM, but there was a couple other factors involved. I had gone through, speaking of vulnerability, I'd gone through a divorce not so much before that, where my wife had left me for another guy. And then I decided to move back to the Midwest because my father had a heart attack, which he recovered from, but I felt like I had just lost three of my last four remaining grandparents. And now my father had the heart attack and my marriage was over. So I was at a point of considerable vulnerability. And yeah, there's lots of ways you could respond to that. I decided to take it as an opportunity to see if I could lift my game and go on to the next stage of my life. So I was doing a lot of reading, trying to understand my own emotions. And it was not just that article from the IBM guy or the Cornell publication. There was also two other pieces. One was a book that was I saw in the library because there often isn't a section on, I guess I'll call it masculinity or something, but it was in the feminist section of the library. And the book was called The Alchemy of Love and Lust, about how we have biochemical reactions, serotonin and, you know, testosterone and all sorts of other things that can really, you know, beyond our consciousness affect our behavior. So that was one, but there was something else as well. On a business trip back in the day when, you know, airlines actually still had magazines that you could ask for to read in flight, it was a Newsweek publication with a very in-depth piece on early childhood. And essentially, the theme was, again, very similar, that there was a lot that's beyond our conscious recognition because so much happens to us early in life. In fact, the article had a quote that I love dearly. It said, you can work really hard as a parent in the first 2 years raising your child, or you can work really hard for the next 20 years. If you're lax in the first two, you got a lot to make up for potentially. And part of that article talked about Bowlby's attachment theory, that essentially it's particularly oriented often to the mother, but it doesn't have to be just the mother. It can be both parents or a surrogate parent or stand-in guardian, whoever the case may be, but whatever is the primary or few primary relationships, do you end up feeling that you are securely attached? Are you anxiously attached? Or are you avoidant and essentially not attached at all because you've gone to a point of, I guess I'll call it rejection or desolation, and feel like you can't form a connection and you've just given up on that source of possible connection. And that was, I just thought, was really an interesting way to frame things. I think we could overlay those three categories from Bowlby: attached, anxiously attached, and avoidant, even in relationship to the seven emotions of facial coding, which are happiness and surprise, anger, sadness, fear, disgust, and contempt. I think we could do that if that's of interest to you and you think to the listeners.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's awesome. While you were explaining the theories, I was thinking about my own experience as a bonus mother and just how it's so fascinating how these different theories kind of play out into our lives and the lives of the people we touch. So yeah, I'd love to explore that. I'm sure my listeners would as well.
Okay. So I think if you look at someone who is, you know, securely attached based on Bowlby's theory, the most obvious emotion to go to is happiness. You know, happiness is really in essence about hugging or connecting. It has wonderful benefits, certainly. There are studies to show that happiness is not a trivial emotion. Happy people are able to brainstorm superior solutions and often more quickly in business settings, for instance. You can imagine the same potential in your personal life. It just feels good to be happy or to have hope for happiness. So that seems the most obvious connection. When you move to the anxiously attached, that obviously suggests fear first and foremost. But what travels along with fear is surprise. In surprise, your eyes go wide, your mouth can drop open a bit, your eyebrows lift to help expand your field of vision. Surprise is really about taking in new information. You feel like there's some kind of change afoot. It can be a positive surprise, like a new car for Christmas. It can be a negative surprise, like a new car accident instead of a new car itself. So we're appraising something when it's surprise, and we arrive at a verdict. And because human beings generally don't like surprises, we have to adapt to them. That means that you know, it can certainly fall into the negative direction. It can be stressful to us as well as a chance to seize opportunities and grow. So the emotion that goes most naturally with surprise is fear. There's a lot of overlap in how those two emotions show on the face. And the only real distinct difference is when the mouth pulls wide in kind of an EGADS expression. That is the singular way in which fear shows that has no overlap with surprise. Mm-hmm. So somebody who is anxiously attached is probably, you know, trying to assess every time, you know, is this now a moment where I can approach that person and we're going to have a nice, you know, bonding opportunity? Am I going to get it kind of, you know, passed over for the moment, dismissed in some fashion? Which one is it going to be now? And as the child, at least, or the child that's still within us, I would say as an adult, we might feel like we're not in control of this situation, that it's bigger than us. Yeah. And that can induce this sense of fear. But at the same time, fear can be very motivating. And I don't want to say that fear is always a negative emotion. I think it's a chance for us to recognize there's a challenge out there and to take it on and to show some courage and go someplace. The last one would be avoidant, where you essentially surrendered. And I think there are more than one emotion that might go here. Certainly one of them that comes to mind immediately is sadness. Sadness as an emotion tends to involve disappointment, a sense of forlornness, a sense that you know, things are hopeless, that they can't be changed. I sometimes think of sadness as almost like nature's way of telling us to slow down, to ponder something, that, you know, a mistake or a problem's arisen, and we shouldn't rush into, you know, the next moment of danger too readily. So sadness, obviously, you know, can get a bum rap as an emotion, but I think sadness has tremendous qualities in terms of causing us to reflect, to ponder, to try to understand something. But that said, we don't want to live our lives entirely in sadness, even though it has beneficial aspects. And I think that is one of the things that certainly can happen, this sense of hopelessness. But I'd bring up at least one other emotion for avoidant, and that is contempt. with contempt, as opposed to the mouth sagging or a wrinkle in the cheeks when you're feeling sad. With contempt, the corner of the mouth lifts up and out. It is a sign, sometimes if it's shared with a smile, it can be a sign of happiness, but often it can be a sign of distrust. So if somebody hasn't really been there for you, it's quite possible that you could move to a stage where you don't trust the other party. And then lo and behold, that can become toxic enough that maybe, just maybe, you don't trust other relationships. And there, the important thing, I think, is to say, don't paint everything with the same brush. That was one relationship, probably a really central relationship, really a foundational relationship. But the challenge and the need and the opportunity, ideally, is to not just give up based on that one person, so that not sadness and contempt is the final resting spot. If you think your orientation based on childhood, early childhood, was a bit more in the avoidant direction. But I think those are certainly emotions that could be pertinent. So I just found, this is a very long answer, and I'm sorry for that, but that possible connection, as I've teased it out and thought about it over the years, I think could really bring a lot of learning to people, because we all do have emotions we gravitate to almost naturally. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think people evolve. And so nothing is set in stone, and one can live and learn and grow accordingly.
Absolutely. That was really helpful. Just kind of hearing you speak about those different things and just the subtle differences that I feel like in the day-to-day we might not even recognize in ourselves or in others. It's really kind of powerful to take a step back and really think about the way emotions and feelings, even from the past, can present themselves physically on us and continue to come up in different facets of our life, in good and bad ways.
Yeah, there's a quote, there's many quotes that I love in life, but one of them is from George Orwell, who said, by the age of 50, a man has the face he deserves, because we do have muscle memory, and people mm-hmm. do have certain expressions they can go to at times. I never disclose what it is, but when I met my wife, she had kind of a signature expression, and I could pick it up right away. It's proven to be true. And she, I remember we were out on maybe our fourth or fifth date, and we were some friends, and they knew what my background was, and they said, does Karen have a signature expression? And I said, oh, absolutely. And then they started trying to tease me and cajole me to say what it was, and I refused. And later, Karen said to me, that was the moment when I realized I could marry you, because I could trust you to keep my secrets, and I was grateful to you for that.
Really interesting. I'm thinking about, I get teased, and I was teased as a kid for like little wrinkles around my eyes, and I've come to like, in, you know, as I've gotten older, appreciate them, because I'm like, it's my smile wrinkles. But it's funny, because my boyfriend's son will be like, why do you have wrinkles right there? But yeah, it speaks to that for me. It's like, yeah, that's my signature face. I smile really big and I have wrinkles. So it's just funny.
And that's what's called a true smile. When the muscle around the eye relaxes, you get the twinkle in the eye and you can get the wrinkles. And, it's a wonderful feeling. I know he's a little bit in disrepute these days, and I would say fairly enough, but Woody Allen had a funny saying. He said, happiness makes up in height what it lacks in length. So a lot of times mm-hmm. in life, we don't get to be as happy as often as we want, but the fireworks emotionally in terms of happiness is certainly the true smile. And if that's what's your signature emotion, that's a pretty good one to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. We can appreciate those wrinkles, right?
That's right. That's what I'm saying. Absolutely.
Awesome.
You're in fact what I call a joy bird in that case, someone who gravitates readily to happiness. And as I said earlier, happy people are really good at brainstorming and being inventive. And there's a lot of value in that.
Thank you for that. Yeah, sure. I feel like that resonates with me. So.
Well, you were inventive enough to create the podcast. So, that's just one sign of things. So, it rebounds in your advantage, and it can rebound to the advantage of others. So it's a giving, generous emotion, happiness is.
Fleeting, but sometimes that's a good thing. I think when we have happiness that's fleeting, it teaches us to really appreciate it, especially when we get into tough times like we're facing right now.
That would be true. We will all appreciate when the virus is behind us. Mm-hmm. I have both a sister-in-law and her daughter who are nurses on the front line in Chicago and D.C., respectively. And so, one of them, in fact, was exposed to a patient who unfortunately died, but the mask fell off while trying to resuscitate the patient. And so we waited several days until just yesterday to learn that it was a negative coronavirus test. So we're very relieved and happy, honestly, because, this was someone who was also being told to go back to work because they're short on nurses given the crisis.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Heavy stuff.
Yeah, it is pretty heavy. You're grateful that the nurses and the doctors show such courage, but you also, at least I, and I'm sure you and others, we have to worry and, maybe even a little guilt-ridden because we can, socially distance ourselves. And yet these are people, along with those who work in grocery stores and elsewhere, who are asked to put themselves out there right now.
Yeah, it's very difficult to kind of separate, what do we need to do, but also the people that can't do those things because they're asked to help, and how can we honor them and support them, and kind of the mixed emotions that come with that.
Yeah, no, you're in a moment. I mean, given the title of your podcast, Vulnerability, I mean, my God, we have the entire world feeling vulnerable, both in terms of their health and then because of the economic ramifications of this. And then you've got social distancing, which can also lead to emotional distancing. I was talking to someone earlier today, and their daughter just had a baby, and they live 15 minutes away by car, and they have not been able to see the newborn yet. So there are just so many ways in which this is playing out in society. So honestly, as we're having this conversation, emotions couldn't be more front and center right now than they are based on world events.
Absolutely. Especially when we are so physically disconnected, I think it's even more so. How can we connect emotionally with people? How can we call them? How can we reach out? How can we be a support? How can we ask for support? It's just so relevant right now.
It is. But it's also a chance to, it slows us down. It takes us away from some of the distractions that otherwise occupy it. So I would also say it's a moment for potentially appreciating others and their role in our lives. God forbid that they weren't available to us. If we're spending more time with our significant other or others, to value that time together. I'm not trying to be Pollyannish about it or just engage in happy talk. You could just be, unhappy about it or have nasty feelings. And I said, I don't really want to go that place. That doesn't make sense to me. I want to use it as a chance to elevate. And it's pretty hard to think about elevating with something as profound a crisis as this, but I'd like to think there's at least some aspects in which it provides some opportunities.
I appreciate you saying that because I feel the same way. I feel I've been sharing a lot of content on my personal pages just about finding the positives and trying to focus on the good and not dismissing that some people are really going through heavy things, but just how can we shift that energy to empowering ourselves and others?
Yeah, it all comes back to people. I mean, People Magazine will never go broke as long as they just stick to the formula, because we're fascinated by people. And it doesn't have to be celebrities. I mean, that's one way you can play it. But it's just, what's the human drama? What do we go through in life? And what can we learn from that?
Yeah, very true. Well, Dan, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on this podcast, for sharing such insightful information about different emotions and the attachment theories, and just really in such a crazy and chaotic time, just taking this time with me to be vulnerable, to speak about your personal life and to share your insight into emotions. I think there's a lot of valuable information that people can take from this. And so I just really appreciate you spending the time talking with me today.
Oh, I was happy to do it.